Welcome back to the Jewish Futurism Lab, where we unpack Torah, tech, and tomorrow. I'm your host, Mike Wirth, Jewish futurist, community artist, and design educator, coming to you from Crown Town, Charlotte, North Carolina. Today, I'm sitting down with Liat Corinne Unger. Liat is the founder and president of Emmet Advocacy, and her journey from speech-language pathologist and Jewish educator to global hostage advocate is a living case study in Jewish futures. Liat and I first connected in late 2023 when she asked artists to create and share portraits of her cousin, Omer Shem Tov, who had been kidnapped during the Nova Music Festival. Let's get into it, y'all. All right, welcome back to the lab, my friends. And today I'm sitting down with a friend and an amazing person who has such a great story. Her name is Liat Corinne Unger. And she first reached out to me early in the weeks after October 7th. And she's now gone through such a transformation, is now president of Emmet Advocacy. And Liat's journey runs from being a speech-language pathologist in Jewish education, doing many incredible things, helping young people find their voices, to a life of advocacy and public storytelling and community action on behalf of hostage families from October 7th. In our conversation, we explore her cousin, Omer Shem Tov, and the portrait campaign that she started, and the role that artists played in keeping his story on social media feeds alive, right, out there in people's faces, right, so they don't forget. And Liat's transition from clinician to advocate and the hopes and fears that she carries going into the future. We also reflect on the strange and creative way that collaboration can become a form of family and solidarity and Jewish responsibility in a time of crisis. So, friends, without further ado, here's my conversation with Liat Corinne Unger. All right, my friends, we're back here in the lab with a friend and amazing person, Liat Corinne Unger. And gosh, Liat, we met when you sent me a message and just said, you know, love your art, have a need. And you told me your story, and I was just instantly connected. So I'm so grateful that you did, and so nice to have you here today.
Thanks for having me, Mike. It's so nice to finally put a face to the person who really stepped up to the call.
Thank you. And we're going to talk about how you stepped up to a much larger call. But with everything that happens on this show, like any good superhero that we're talking to, we have to learn about your origin story, right? And understand how you became the amazing person that you are today, so that we can learn, right? Can we see, you know, what it takes to do what you've done? So before, right, our story today kind of centers around October 7th, centers around Omer Shem Tov, your cousin. And, you know, before all that stuff, right, the Balagan, you were working in New York as a speech language pathologist and learning specialist. And you were running the Art of Communication.
Yes.
Right, in New York. And also at places like Ramaz School, KinderCare, Kids EI, Language Fundamentals. Like, wow, what a list. So can you kind of take us back to that life and like paint us a picture?
Sure. So a lot of that work was done in my early in my career. I opened a private practice sometime, I want to say in 2014, as I was working simultaneously in different school institutions. And then, you know, shortly after COVID, you know, I bounced around a bit because of COVID, but then shortly after COVID, I, with my family, moved to New Jersey. And I had just decided to sort of branch out here. So I opened up a learning center, piloting a learning center in an all boys high school. And doors opened September 1st. And I was there to support, you know, high school boys who had learning challenges, helping them sort of, you know, get their thoughts and organized, get their act together, what we call, get their thoughts from their, you know, from their brain, which they had, and they wanted to express, whether it was in a written capability, in a written modality, or if it was, you know, verbally, but their hands or their, you know, their mouths wouldn't cooperate. So we had just opened that on September 1st within a high school. And I would say 4 weeks later, October 7th hit. And so that kind of got sidelined for a few weeks, but then it ultimately shut the doors very, very quickly after. And that plan sort of that I waited for and sort of put into practice became essentially irrelevant within a few hours of October 7th's attack.
And I mean, we're not going to try and make you relive the time, right, of the unknown, but that was the scary, scary part, right? And that certainly would disrupt any sort of initiative and things that you had going on. But you didn't really, that was maybe a shorter time for you, or you pivoted pretty quick because you put yourself into action pretty fast.
Yes, very, very quickly.
And you were still president, right, at the Art of Communication?
Yes.
In New York, right, when you messaged me and other artists, you know, asking us to create our interpretation of Omer, right, and share and to take your message. And, you know, from the vantage point of that New York therapy and education world, you know, what made you decide to go to artists and use that as your, like, launch point?
Well, it's always been, art has always been something that feels like it's a part of me. And I feel like when I became an adult and I had to put on like my big girl pants and work and all that, that need for expressing myself creatively didn't vanish. So yes, I would, continue to paint as a hobby or draw or, create, you know, little things, whether it was for my kids, I would decorate their backpacks and things like that. But it also became something that I used to express in my daily life as, like, you know, through fashion, through interior design of my home and like other elements of my daily life. I think that with the understanding that social media, it was such a powerful tool and visuals are a lot easier to connect to, especially with the attention spans that people have today. And also, that was a big motivator in reaching out to various artists and also artists that reach out to us. But I think also, you know, I think the point was, is that no matter what skill you had, and everyone has a skill, a raw talent, whether that's speaking, whether that's drawing, whether that's playing music, you could advocate and you could help maintain awareness about the hostage crisis. And I think that's really what this was about, is that, you know, I just gave a lecture at a conference this 2 days ago. And I think that was like the kind of the takeaway that I wanted the students and educators to walk away with, is that you don't have to be a speaker. You don't have to know foreign policy. You don't have to be an expert in international relations to advocate for the thing that you're passionate about, or to be involved in something. And so you could really take it anywhere. There were people who were singers. There were people who were home cooks, you know, and they did things to raise awareness about the hostages. So Omer has celiac disease. They would come up with gluten-free recipes for challah and for different things. And putting it out on the internet was a way to, on the internet, I just aged myself, on social media, on Instagram, was a really unique way to advocate. And they reached a different type of people, a different audience. So art to me was just a natural, it was just a natural thing that I gravitated towards.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like, you know, us early on saying that, like, arts, pictures and things and film and video and whatever, or, you know, the traditional things, you expanded art and I think Jewish art, right, into this much more nebulous space. And you even identified places in your own home and the way that you've kind of carried on your creativity, which seems to be like part of your ruach, right? And you're able to make that happen. Can I ask, like, did you as a creative in this time, did you make any art that you kind of used a little bit therapeutically?
I did. I don't know if it was so much therapy. Maybe it was. Yeah, I guess it was. I could say therapeutically, but I actually used it as advocacy too. I don't know if you, I don't know if I posted it on Instagram, but there are several pieces that I made to cope with the situation about Omer that were really intense emotionally. There were also ones that I did to you know, pieces that I created for, it was the first time I worked in the digital art world. So I had to really learn that from scratch. You know, there was a friend who survived the Nova and then she went to Thailand to process. And so like, you know, one of the things I did was, you know, I created something for her as a gift to her. And it was like a piece of art on social media, a digital piece of art with her releasing this lantern into the sky. And that was sort of like her, you know, her calling, you know, or her way of sort of releasing some of her pain, also advocating, also disconnecting. You know, when Arnon Zmora died in the operation that saved, rescued Nora Gamani, Andrei Kozlov, Almog, and Almog Meirjan, and Shlomi Ziv. I'm still working on a piece, actually, and that was purely therapeutic. I haven't been able to finish it. It's been 2 years, but I will get there. So definitely therapeutic, definitely in terms of my advocacy as well. There were some really intense pieces that were even difficult for me. Like, I haven't looked back at them since. Like, I posted and never looked back because they were so intense.
No, I think I ask because many, many folks have pieces like that, you know, that may never, I'm getting a little emotional here, right? Like, see the light of day just because you needed to take that out of you, you know, and put it into some other something. And that's, you know, the power of energy, right? I think really, thank you for sharing that. I know that that went a little personal there, but.
No, not at all. I'm an open book.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you. So you've gone through all these professional roles and, you know, October 7th has happened and you're in this new role, right, in the Met advocacy. And, you know, tell us how all that stuff has like made you be amazing and put this organization together and put it together in your own way. That's like, you know, not any other type of group that does this work.
It started out of necessity and then a pivot and passion, and it happened really organically. So it wasn't anything that I didn't necessarily have a vision when I started it. I just knew that I wanted to do something and I didn't know what that would look like and how it would manifest. But I said, let's just fake it till you make it. Let's just start something. Let's just roll with the punches. And I remember, you know, speaking to my accountant and saying that he said to me, like, you need a name. And I'm like, well, what is it? And I just like thought really intensely that night. And I was like, well, what is it? And I just said, like, everything that I believe in, everything that I want to do is about truth. And that's what Emmet means. And whatever, if that's Israel advocacy, if that's, you know, combating anti-Semitism, if it's whatever it is, it's about truth and being a true person and an authentic person and, you know, staying true to yourself. And also, like, for me, truth is also not abandoning your humanity and all these different values and principles that I wanted to keep in there, but and weave in somehow to this mission that I didn't know what the mission was. And it's still evolving as we speak. But essentially it started as a way to advocate and it morphed into a way to platform people's stories and voices of truth, which are started initially with just Omer and sharing his story in the places that I had been to that I promised them. One of my ways that we were raised also in Omer's house, in my house, is that words carry a big weight and an energy, and we believe in manifesting. So one of the things when I went to speak around the world about him was like, well, this is just a piece of the story that we know, but don't worry, Olmo's coming back and he's going to share the rest of it with you. And so people actually took me up on that offer when it happened. So it became a speaking platform, like a speaker's bureau. And, you know, of people who just wanted to hear the story. And then it was more about even just outreach, like placing him in front of people or his story in front of people that needed to hear it, that were on the fence, that were are unsure, that have whole different viewpoints, and bringing that element of humanity into advocacy that sometimes is often forgotten. It's why people start, but it's often lost in the process. And then, you know, it was like a way for me to help them process. And then other speakers, you know, former released hostages came over and said, can you help me? And so it felt like for me, like a way to also give back to them and give them a way to process in a way that was productive for them and beneficial for them, and also beneficial for diaspora communities who really needed to hear and learn from the strength and the resilience of people who survived the unimaginable. And so that's how it really started. And it's so slowly morphing into more outreach, more bridge building, more dialogue-based campus conversation, tabling, you know, it's morphing as we speak and it's evolving, and I'm excited to see where it goes, but that's sort of, you know, how it started.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing that I thought of when I first started reading the literature and the things you guys were putting out, I thought, man, that's a brilliant name, because not only is it just like strong in its logic, right? Truth will set you through, like so many things connect and give us strength and power. And I immediately thought of the Golem story with Rabbi Yehuda Lowe, right, from Prague, that written on the Golem, the clay man, right, who comes to life with Kabbalistic magic, the legend, the kill switch to stop him, right, because he goes rogue, is written on his forehead is Emet, right? And
wow.
In that, I was like, oh, so just pretend you knew that and just agree.
Ooh, I think I'm just going to add that into like somehow the mission statement. Like, guys, there's a Golem story, and that's what this story is. The name of our business is, of our organization is named on. That's actually amazing that the thing to, that's really it, by the way. It's to combat the darkness, to combat and dispel the propaganda. Yeah,
y'all are protectors, and like that's a, you know, yeah.
Yeah, the protectors of truth, the bringers of truth. Yeah, that's pretty accurate. All and right. Somehow it feels like it's, I really like that. I like that a lot.
Dope, look at that, a Mike Midrash. I get one of those a year.
I like it. The Rambam, the M and the men in Rambam stands for Mike.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I'm usually part of the perplexed, so I'll take that. Oh man, well, you know, this was something born out of necessity, and I think you've built something that's got such strengths and uses you and your whole persona, right, as an individual, and the work that you've done, the team that you've built. I think that's awesome, right? That's the strongest thing that you can be. You know, thinking about when hostages came back and using your professional lens for a moment, right? And also maybe we can talk a little bit about messaging and propaganda, because as a speech pathologist and you know, language therapist and expert in language, the way, and even your family experience, right? You were talking about yours and Omer's homes where words matter, right? Like immediately I'm like, yep, same in my house, you know, like that's exactly right. What are things that you see, patterns, you know, that like struck you as a professional that made you go or surprised you?
In terms of propaganda or in terms of the hostages who returned, or both?
On question. Could we start with hostages? Was there anything that you saw or heard, right, in the way that they were speaking or acting, you know, that like perhaps you were able to see things between the lines, and then propaganda too, if that's all right, or you can choose one.
I would say that as a professional, and you can separate me from the profession, but like somehow that profession still exists within you. Mm-hmm. When they listen, it was a different context, right? When you're sitting in the hospital and Oma is there, and we're just family sitting in a circle, and he's sharing like these crazy stories. Mm-hmm. I think that what I saw as a human, as a family member, as just a person, and then beyond that as a professional, was that first of all, there was so much emotion and humanity. I know it sounds weird, but like humanity in what he was sharing, and like the little things, and the fact that, like, just as an example, he had a biscuit, and he, you know, at one point, and they gave him like a cookie or a biscuit a day, and the way he had to calculate it, and the fact that he had to say to myself, like, I don't know what time of day it is, I don't know when my next meal is, but I have to calculate it, and how rational thinking he had, but still so, you know, clear after, despite being malnourished and starved and in the darkness and all these things. It's like, well, how do you, first of all, process this as a human being, right? He's obviously sharing it, not because we prompted, but because he's sharing it to get it out. And as a professional who sort of minored in psychology, you know, maybe he's sharing this because he needs to get it out. And then I wonder if it will be beneficial for, in the aftermath, not immediately, but I wonder if this will be beneficial for him to share this further out. And then, you know, he's such a good storyteller, which I've always known, but like, you wouldn't know that he was such a good storyteller about something so painful and something so emotional and something so traumatic. How storytelling really is the crux of, I think, everything, which is a whole different perspective that I have, but and his, how good his English was, and the fact that he could really cross boundaries, and and also even when we pull this back to and this is for Omer specifically, but for all of them really, but my thinking started with Omer because he was, you know, my family member, but you know, how with this propaganda that's being thrown out on college campuses and in the world, well, how do you, you know, fight that? How do you dispel that? How do you correct that? And it goes back to truth, through truth, through humanity, through storytelling, through emotion, not through arguing, not through debating, not through yelling past each other. It's really having an emotional human connection and telling not your truth, but the truth. And of course it's your truth, but I think that's where it started. And then hearing the same like little gems and little tidbits from Maya Regev and Eliyah Cohen and all these things that I said to myself, like as a professional, I never looked at it as a professional. I always looked at it as a family member, because you have to remember these kids are their kids and they're Omer's friends. And so to me, I took them on as like nieces and nephews. I told them, like, you don't think that like this is it. Like, you're now my nieces and nephews. Like, you don't have a choice. So I'm going to treat you like an old woman auntie. But when you think of it as a professional, you're like, this can really move the needle in bringing people closer together, different sides of the aisle, different perspectives, and just from the humanity standpoint, just from the truth. And the elegance and the eloquence, and these such young kids who can really articulate things in such a elegant way. And to me, that was really powerful. And I felt like it was such an important way to reason also to harness that and platform them and give a platform for voices of truth, essentially.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like, thank you for answering the question that way. All right. I asked you, thinking that your clinical brain is somehow on during a time when you have a direct emotional experience. So forgive me for.
But by the way, afterwards, that clinical brain was completely on, when, because at the end of the day, none of us came in as professional, you know, speakers. that clinical brain came on and we sat and we practiced how to deliver and how to do and how to change and how to speech write and how to change and how to be emotive and when to pause. And that clinical brain came on later on, but in the initial moments, at least.
Just had to be. Yeah. Wow. That's absolutely fascinating. You know, the media, like when Omer came home, oh my God, right? Like, what a day. Like I felt the rush again, you know, like, you had really, anybody connected to the project, me included, other artists who I connected with as a result of being in this, you know, my world grew in that way. We became very connected to Omer. You know, I have celiac disease, so I would actually like some of those recipes, please, for challah, because, you know, I live in the midbar of Jewish world, and, you know, in North Carolina, gluten-free challah is a rare thing.
Yes. By the way, there's a place here, Modern Breads. It doesn't taste gluten-free. That's how good it is.
Wow. See, that's...
I wonder if I'll ask her. The owner is a friend, and I wonder if I can ask her if she can make a frozen version. I can ship it to you.
You would get Hanukkah presents every year.
I love it. For life. Doing it just for the Hanukkah presents.
Yes, that was such a joyous day. I mean, so many joyous days that were, you know, had. You were gripped to the news that the Jewish world was with you, right, during that time. And oh my God, like, so yes, the media, as you're describing, has been this tsunami, right? And you're still dealing with it, you know, now even with Emmet. So what are some things you've learned, you know, not like how to be on camera, but like, what are some truths? What are some things, like patterns you notice? How does the media approach you and frame situations? And, you know, what's it look like these days?
So I have to say that, you know, with regard to being on the news and being interviewed so much while Omer was in captivity, I have to say that overall, relatively, the media was very gentle, and with me, at least. I can only speak to my experience, but and I respect. I think they understood that it was a very sensitive time, so you couldn't, you know, sort of handle. It's not like Pierce Morgan on your show. This is a family member. It's a little different. So it was handled a bit more with sensitivity. Through other things, I learned that the media also, you know, unfortunately, not with regard to the hostage situation, at least on my personal interviews, I'm sure with other things. Yeah, the media twists and turns things and unfortunately portrays things very, very differently than what they are. Sometimes they're very selective in what they show. They sometimes, you know, share things very irresponsibly. And unethically, it's sort of this unethical, in my book, journalism. But that's, I think, like a greater problem. And I don't know that you can enforce sort of these journalistic standards. There should be a way to enforce journalistic standards, but in this country, because we have freedom of speech, I think it's a bit more complicated. But yeah, you know, I think it's very irresponsible when people release information before it's verified and they don't realize that it translates into real world harm for people. But overall, I think it's, you know, my experience with media has been okay so far on a personal level. I am very much distraught with the way things are portrayed. I had just put out a reactive video on Instagram, actually, about how I think that, you know, interviewers, journalists, media, entertain certain ideas and questions that I don't think have merit to be entertained. You know, one of the most recent things that I really have had a knee-jerk reaction to was like a gut reaction to was, you know, somebody on CNN, I forgot the name of the journalist, she asked, if Israel has the right to exist, and it's constantly something that's thrown, or do they think that the, you know, who they're interviewing has the right to exist? And so many people have entertained this question and ask it, maybe because they're trying to expose the double standard, maybe not, maybe there's good intention behind it, maybe not. My feeling is that we've entertained this question for way too long. Israel exists, full stop, period. And, you know, I almost want to, the next time someone asks that question, be like, I refuse to answer that question. It's a degrading question, and I will leave if that's something that you think that is appropriate for you to ask. So yeah, that's my rant on media. I don't know if I answered your question, but yeah.
No, you did. You did. And, you know, I'm glad, because, you know, you're pointing out something really important that, like, a lot of Jewish people need to fully realize, which is, like, traditional media carries libel and extends propaganda in a way that it hasn't in a century. Right.
Yes.
And in the United States of all places. Right. Like, it's so it's OK to feel weird and say, no, that's wrong. When a traditional media source that you've come to rely on for a long time, right? And here you are as somebody on in those spaces, right? Appreciating that, like, they're nice and they're gentle, right? At the appropriate time, but wow, do they have a permission platform, a scaffold, right? What do they call that? Permission scaffold? Permission structure now to ask questions like, does Israel have the right to exist? And for what reason? Like, what qualifies that? Because we could take those reasons and then line up 50 countries before I'm exaggerating, but like, how about dozen countries before we even talk about Israel, right? For a bad metric. I think like there is a libel storm at the moment. And the degree of it is varying in where you live and places and media you consume, but independent media sources, right? Ones that, because there are some good traditional media sources, but you would say they're hard to find, right?
Very, very hard to find. I don't know if it would be traditional media, but it's very hard to find good, reliable, and with journalistic integrity, I would say. But yeah.
What do you like? I mean, I know that could change sometimes, but like, is there stuff that you feel is trustworthy for you? Like, I like Times of Israel, for example,
Israel. I like, for American, more American based, I'm really into the Free Press. I'm really into honest reporting. They're not traditional legacy media, but they're definitely have a bit more journalistic integrity.
Barry Weiss, wasn't Barry yes. Weiss, right? Who Excellent. Left traditional media to start yes. the Free Press is behind.
Yes.
Yes.
Listen, sometimes, unfortunately, and it's just the way of the world and the way things unfortunately evolve, sometimes for the worse. Sometimes things get rotten from the inside. And so sometimes you can't even fix what's rotten. You have to really just start something new. And I think the Free Press has done a really good job with bringing something fresh, upholding journalistic integrity and different standards. And I think Barry Weiss is doing an amazing job. And I don't care what anyone else says, but kudos to her. Honest reporting does the same.
Doda Liat.
Yes, Doda Liat, you're fair.
Ken, what? Tell us about your transformation, right? Who is Doda Liat now? Right. Well, she is Doda Liat. That's it.
I'm still Doda Liat to everyone.
Yeah.
Who is Doda Liat now?
Yeah.
That's the question.
Who she become?
It's funny. I think I was always these things, but I think I'm just more intentional about being very public with it. I was much more of a private individual. And I think that, just in a nutshell, I've just been so I've always been, you know, cheesy to say, but a loud and proud and unapologetic Jewish Zionist Israeli. But I just make it more of a point to be very intentional and on my daily and bring it out in my daily, you know, routine, whether it's, you know, I'll never take this off. This is just the map of the state of Israel, and it says Yichi Am Yisrael, which is it's instead of Am Yisrael Chai, it's Yichi. It will live. It is living. So I like the way that it says that. It's, you know, making sure that my kids hear Hebrew, listen to different perspectives, learn about things. I made a very intentional choice also before, but I'm a bit more proactive about it, but bringing light to, you know, Jewish pioneers in the world, whether it was like Ruth Bader Ginsburg or, you know, the founder of Hadassah Hospital, who was an American nurse. And I just like, you know, they're young, my kids are young. So it's just a very intentional choice. It's making sure there's Hebrew music always on in the background. Liat is also, Dode Liat is also, an advocate through and through, in every part of her life, whether it's on social media, whether it's behind the scenes when I'm lobbying, whether it's, you know, in my daily conversations, even if it's about fashion, because I prefer to support a Jewish owned brand, a pro-Israel brand, a Zionist brand, an Israeli brand, or an allied brand. And that goes the same with, you know, designing my home. We just bought our first house after that was delayed, you know, because of the war, trying to use as many Israeli vendors as possible. Thank you so much. Israel, as many Israeli vendors as possible. You know, all that stuff is who Liat is, who Liat always was, and who she will continue to be. She's someone who's going to strive and continue striving to bring truth to the world through light and positivity, less negativity. I'm an educator through and through. I'm still always going to be a communication specialist because I think that that's what breaks barriers, a bridge builder within our community, within the Jewish world and outside of it. And a connector. And I just hope that I always have clarity, wisdom, and strength to continue to keep doing good in the world and bring that to my daily life, but also, you know, my goals for my life, you know, and I hope to see the progress in it, you know, all the time. So I hope that answered your question.
It did beautifully. And you know, what would you tell the young 20 something teen, or even, you know, 30 something or 40 something, who's like, I want to do something, right? Like, I feel the call. What do you want to have them know?
So I shared this at the conference 2 years ago. For 30 something years of my life, it's interesting. I always like, even, you know, obviously social media didn't exist for 30 something years, but,
thank God.
Yeah, totally. I always, you know, I used to look at like Noah Tishby when she first started out. I grew up watching her she was an actress, and I was on my grandparents' couch in Israel. And that's how I grew up knowing her. And then she turned into this advocate, and I always wanted to do that, but I like didn't have a reason to, and God gave me that reason. So don't ask for the reason, but I never did, because I mean, I did it like very, not me front facing. It was more like, that's what I would share to my story and all that stuff. Like things that were important to me, raising awareness, you know, to the persecution of women in Iran and things like that. But it was less like front facing, frontal, like me advocating with my own words and my own voice. And I think that was because I created a rule in my head that someone more qualified, someone more experienced, someone who has more of a background, who's more professional, who should and will be doing it. And so this imaginary boundary and rule that I created for myself, it was this like unwritten rule, prevented me from doing what I wanted to do and what I guess I knew I needed to do my whole life, just because I invented a rule in my head. And what I would say to anyone at any age, but especially the young people that, you know, I remember at that time where I felt like I was untouchable, unbreakable, and all that stuff. But these fears of what to do. And if you have an idea and you want to do something, whatever's holding you back, stop. Because just get rid of the rule. Because when I went to speak to the president of the United States and I hunted him down and stalked him and found where he was eating, when I went and walked into a room with a congressman or woman or a senator or a diplomat or the UN secretary general, I didn't have a strategy. I didn't have a plan. I didn't have experience. I didn't know my arm from my leg. I didn't know what bipartisan meant. Okay. I literally had to Google it and ChatGPT it in a bathroom stall. I shared that, but it's true. It's accurate. Just do it. Just start and figure it out. It always ends up either working out or revealing something better at the end. And so get rid of the rules that you create for yourself, because those are boundaries you created. They don't actually exist.
Padma, I love it. Yalla. Oh, man. Well, Liat, this has been just such a pleasure. And thank you for the time. Wow. We're going to have you back at some point. There's so much we want to keep up with you on. So thank you, my dear. You have been listening to the Jewish Futurism Lab with Mike Wirth, a weekly independent production of Mike Wirth Art Incorporated. You can connect with the show at jewishfuturismlab.com, and we're on all of your favorite podcast platforms. We'd love for you to subscribe, comment, and leave a review so other seekers can find the show too. New episodes come out Friday mornings, East Coast time. And if you or someone you know is a Jewish futurist doing fascinating work, message me on Instagram. I'm at Mike Wirth, W-I-R-T-H. Until next time, keep imagining, keep questioning, and keep building. I'll see you in the future.